And now it's time for a special edition of Josh's Library Corner. All right, Josh, today we've got a very special book, and it's not your usual true crime pick. It is a new release from Kensington Books by author Dandy Smith called The Wedding Vow. I know, Josh, that you've not yet finished the book, but what can you share with our listeners as to why they should check out The Wedding Vow and why it's the perfect spring-summer read?
Well, I'm only 50 pages into the book, but the gist of the story is that Verity, the founder of a wellness brand, has been married to Lyndon for 5 years. And when Lyndon is murdered and his secrets start to reveal themselves, it leaves Verity with a lot more questions and pain than answers. You know how we joke about throwing away our computers and dumping out our nightstands when we die?
Oh, yes.
Well, Lyndon didn't have that plan, and it turns out that he was hiding some not-so-good stuff under a floorboard.
Ooh.
That's the point I just reached in the book.
That's juicy.
The Wedding Vow really hits on the fear of whether or not you can really ever know somebody, even if it's your spouse. We made wedding vows.
We did.
And we don't know each other at all.
Not even a little.
We have so many floorboards, so many secrets.
That is genuinely a fear of mine.
And I'm a little worried that she may not make it through before becoming a victim herself.
Wow. That's quite the tease. If you enjoy a domestic suspense thriller where nothing is quite as it seems, The Wedding Vow has everything you'd expect and so much you wouldn't. The Wedding Vow is packed with tension, deception, and the kind of twists that make you stop and go, oh, okay, so everyone here is just going to make the worst choices. The Wedding Vow by Dandy Smith is available now wherever books are sold. On April 9th, 2006, a memorial service was held at the entrance of Delray Beach on the Oregon coast. During that somber ceremony, there was an offer of comfort and closure for the families of Elena Jacobs, Teresa Cruz, and Doreen Raderman. Three crosses stood in the parking lot instead of three young women. Over the next two episodes, I'll be sharing the unsolved case of the double murder of Elena and Teresa and the sort of solved case of Doreen Raderman. In 1978, two young women were reported missing by the unappealingly named Tongue Point Job Corps Center in Astoria, Oregon. Those women were from Alaska. Astoria is a long way from home, but in the 1970s, there was a big push to have Alaskan natives participate in Job Corps. An extensive article in the Anchorage Times in 1976 discussed how the goal of Job Corps was to turn tax burdens into taxpayers. Yikes! According to the Department of Labor, which oversees the program, Job Corps is a nationwide career training program. Eligible participants are between 16 and 24 years old. The purpose of the training is to help those enrolled finish their high school education, train for careers, and provide assistance with finding a job. Since 1964, the program has helped over 2 million people. Part of the cost of running the program is that students are provided access to room and board while receiving career-specific training. Other costs can include transportation, transitional support, childcare, and more. The goal presented by Job Corps is that they provide the skills and training necessary to persons that they feel may slip through the cracks of opportunity, allowing them to receive a higher education, better-paying jobs, or they can continue to support the government and join the military. A side note about Job Corps' current standing. In 2025, the Department of Labor paused operations at all centers after an internal review found the program wasn't operating as well as it could or should have been. While the program has received bipartisan support for decades, Nixon, Reagan, and Trump have all been after it. So that gives you an idea of the good that it does, because when those guys are wanting to destroy something, I automatically think, oh, it must be helping people. And a big reason for that closure in 2025 was to meet the needs of Trump's budget. Internal investigations filed incident reports, which were used as a reason for the shutdown, saying the program wasn't reaching the intended outcomes and was burning through a lot of money. In the spring of 25, the first ever Job Corps transparency report was presented. It found that the average graduation rate was 38.6%. The cost per student per year was over $80,000, and it was about $155,000 for a student to graduate. So, yes, I don't agree with the person or the reason why we're looking at the budget, but perhaps some restructuring would be helpful. As for the safety of the program, in 2023, there were 14,913 infractions. This included 2,700 incidents of drug use, 1,800 hospital visits, 1,700 acts of violence, 1,100 breaches of security, and 372 sexual assaults or inappropriate sexual behavior. The cost combined with the deficit combined with the incidents led to the Department of Labor deciding that it just wasn't worth running anymore. And those numbers are high, and those weren't the exact numbers, but it's also, we're talking about 15 to 21 or whatever the age limit, and it's kids that are struggling in school. So it's really not shocking. It's kind of like an alternative high school, you know, so you're automatically dealing with kids that might be having substance use issues or coming from violent situations. So those numbers aren't totally shocking to me. If that incident report had been made in 1978, it would have included two murders. Back in the mid-1970s, it was only $6,200 per student per year for the Job Corps. That cost was seen as a deal because the goal was to keep students from relying on government assistance. So we pay $6,000 now, we won't have to support you for $100,000 over the next 10 years. That was kind of the whole idea. 21 focused skills were offered at Job Corps, including but not limited to heavy equipment operation, carpentry, clerical work, food service, cosmetology, forestry, and technology. A successful student could then get a job, return to school, or join the military. Alaska was a big recruitment hub, as so many young Indigenous people were not prepared with the tools the lower 48 felt were necessary for success. Many of the enlistees were sent to Job Corps locations in Oregon and Washington. Getting kids to start their new lives as adults was easier said than done. There was a 50% dropout rate, 30% of which did so in the first 3 months. Of those who stayed, only 20% were considered job ready, even if they hadn't learned as many skills as the program hoped. Back then, there were teams that helped the young women and teen girls who were using the program for reasons outside of education. For example, they found many young women were using Job Corps as an escape from their home lives or problems they were facing. Many of the girls came from Indigenous villages in Alaska, and once they were sent to Oregon or Washington, they became homesick and overwhelmed with the changes. Understandable, they were 2,500 miles from home, and now you're in big cities, not these remote villages. That would be a lot. One suggestion was to have a more thorough screening process to make sure the disadvantaged target demographic was ready for such changes and structure before investing in their future. This wasn't really possible as the recruiters were told to be selective and fast. Those standards can't coexist, so being quick and getting a lot of people enrolled, that won out. So basically, they were told, hey, be really picky about who you're getting. We don't want to take all this time and money and pay to have them come all these miles away only to have them drop out, but also get a lot of people as fast as possible. You can't do both. You just can't.
It's just not possible.
In that article from 76, two women were used as examples. Sarah, who was about to start a career with RCA Alaska Communications, and Terry, who was working in an ice cream shop. Oh, Terry, what a horrible and embarrassing fate, as if serving ice cream is so degrading while she figures out what she wants to do with her future. They were very dismissive of her, like, oh, she failed at Job Corps. And now look at her. She has to scoop ice cream. Yeah, she's like 18, 19. That's okay.
Yeah, 18, 19. I feel like you still got a lot more time to.
Oh, yeah.
That's when you should be figuring it out. That's not when you have to have it figured out.
Yeah, you got like.
You got to start here.
Yes, you got 10 years of crappy jobs
least.
Ahead of you.
How rude.
It was very rude, yes. The successful example, Sarah, was sent to Tongue Point in Astoria. It was one of five centers Alaskans would be assigned to. The others were in Portland and Yahats in Oregon, Curlew and White Swan in Washington. For anyone unfamiliar with Oregon geography, okay, so you know how Oregon is pretty much a square except for the little bloop in the northwest corner. That is where Astoria is. It is home to the Goonies house, the school from Kindergarten Cop, the bridge from Free Willy, and much, much more. Tongue Point was one of only five residential training centers here in the Pacific Northwest, making me say, Tongue Point was actually operated by the Manpower Administration of the Labor Department, which was a private corporation. Operations were eventually taken over by RCA, almost like it wasn't a place focused on training you for the future of your choice, but maybe trapping you in an obligation. I just find that interesting that Sarah graduated the program and then got a job with the company who's running the program.
Well, there's that hint of suspicious stuff I was thinking about.
Yeah, it's like secret internship that you don't know you're a part of. When interviewed, Sarah, the graduate who had dropped out at one point, gave details as to why she didn't finish the program on her first try. It was mostly due to the space and program not feeling how she had expected. The dorms were more like military barracks. It felt like juvie, not a place of learning. New recruits would be separated from the rest of the students for up to a month. Rules were strict and enforcement was rigid. The living situation was the hardest, which I can only imagine. A lot of different lifestyles, customs, outlooks on life. And that was the main reason Sarah said that she had quit the first time after only a month. So it was basically just really jarring to go from a small village in Alaska to now sharing a room with a bunch of teens, basically. On her second go of it, Sarah graduated the program as a clerical typist. A main reason for the second attempt being successful was that she knew what to expect when she got there. Conditions sound like they were on the verge of extreme, compounded with this being your first time away from home, and if home is a tiny fishing village in Alaska, and you're now living with people from all around the country in Astoria, Oregon, that's a lot. Another reason she was successful was that with RCA's takeover, the lifestyle of the program relaxed a little bit and even implemented a reward system for those who were focused on their personal success. For Sarah, Job Corps was a good way for her to learn the skills she needed for a career. For Terry, the lack of organization within Job Corps was what led to her dropping out. She specifically joined as she had a goal of becoming a cook. High school wasn't working, so she dropped out and soon found herself in Astoria. However, there wasn't a proper enlistment protocol, so when she arrived, all of the courses focusing on cooking and food services were full. So instead of getting in the course and working toward her goal, she was painted as a failure because they didn't bother to make sure that they had placement for her. One of the perks of the Tongue Point location was that it was right at the water. The view overlooked the famous Astoria Megler Bridge, and the backyard was the Columbia River Pacific Ocean tributary. So outings were usually quite beautiful and relaxing. I don't have the backgrounds for Elena Jacobs or Teresa Krause, but what I do know is that the teenagers had come to Tongue Point from Alaska the first week of March. Once together, they were known for being inseparable. If one was going somewhere, the other was probably going to be following. Teresa M. Krause was born August 9th, 1958, in the village of Aleknagik. For context, that village, with a population in the 1970s of 128, is about 150 miles south of Bethel, which is 400 miles west of Anchorage. These tiny towns are on the furthest western part of Alaska and are only accessible via boat or plane. Without knowing their backgrounds, we're left to fill in the blanks. Given the history of Alaskan women going to the Job Corps location in Astoria, we can assume that they may have wanted to escape something, had been struggling in school, or had hoped for more opportunities by exploring other parts of the world. For Teresa, some behaviors may have led to the decision or forced option to join. In November 1977, 19-year-old Teresa was riding in a vehicle with presumed friends, a 17-year-old boy, and Christian Chukwuk. Christian's driving caught the attention of the authorities, and he was pulled over. His blood alcohol was 0.22. That's a lot.
Yeehaw!
Yeah, he was arrested for drunk driving.
Woo!
Teresa and the minor were both charged with disorderly conduct for making a scene with the officers. The report doesn't state if she was drinking as well, but I would assume so. And that charge was later dismissed. Teresa wound up in Astoria, but that did not make her issues magically disappear. She was once again fined for disorderly conduct on May 4th, 1978. Her fine was $53, which was a lot back then. It would be like getting a $271 ticket today.
At Job Corps, they weren't making money yet. They're just being housed, going to school.
Yeah, so you're kind of trading room and board to become this person. And I'm sure that's why there were deals with companies of, hey, we got some young people that are ready for jobs. For how rigid the rules supposedly were at Tongue Point, this incident didn't appear to have any effect on Teresa's enrollment with Job Corps. Sadly, I know even less about Elena Jacobs' life. Unlike Teresa, Elena came from the booming town of Bethel with a population of about 2,500 back in the 70s. Making information even more difficult was the distance and lack of technology. Teresa's charge of disorderly conduct said she was 19. In May of 1978, she was 19. Other articles, Elena was 19 and Teresa was 18. Some said that they were both 19. I don't have Elena's actual birth date. Maybe she didn't even know her exact age. So I would say she was between 18 and 20. Teresa was for sure 19, 3 months away from turning 20. They're both 19, I would say. On May 20th, 1978, 2 weeks after Teresa's disorderly conduct, the young ladies were planning on a night out. They received an evening pass. The details on the pass are vague at best. Job Corps isn't a military operation, but they're sort of cousins. To leave the campus, because you are technically employed by Job Corps, you need to get a pass. What the teenagers had planned for their outing was unknown, but they had informed staff or the pass providers that they would be back that night. They bothered to get a pass. They didn't just take off. They left their personal belongings, including personal checks and clothing, in their living quarters. There was no sign that they were planning on running away or even leaving the program. The girls did not return from that night out. This is probably the most upsetting and unclear bit of information surrounding this case. The girls left the night of May 20th and did not return. In later reports, it's claimed the Clatsop County Sheriff's Office had been investigating their supposed disappearance. However, it's very possible that that was not the case. During this time, Job Corps shared their policy for perceived AWOL students. Tongue Point Job Corps regularly terminated students who were either absent or out of contact for 15 days. As I already discussed, dropout and incompletion rates were quite high, and some of the students were adult-aged, so only so much could be done. At the time, the director of TPJC, Ed Ludman, said that if a student appears to have left the program, the parents of that student and the person who recruited them, called a scanner, are informed after 24 hours. The way a disappearance is noticed is through daily bed checks. According to his own protocol, this is what should have transpired. On May 20th, the girls get the night pass, leave, and don't return. On the 21st, the bed check would have shown that they did not come back. Maybe they wanted to be sure the girls were gone for 24 hours, so they didn't mark them as missing until the 22nd, after the second bed check. Once that absence was confirmed, Job Corps staff would have reached out to friends and teachers on campus to find out any pertinent information. I do find it hard to believe that in the age of long before cell phones, that either girl's family was informed of their disappearance within a reasonable amount of time. They were in a rural part of Alaska. So how much effort was really made? After the confirmed 24 hours, staff gathered the belongings left behind by both girls and kept them in a lost and found of sorts. What has myself and others who are aware of the case quite confused is how, on one hand, it was reported the girls were being looked for. That doesn't seem to make sense according to their own process, because both Elena and Teresa were adults and the program is voluntary. So by their own guidelines, they would not have reported their disappearance to authorities. As far as anyone even slightly familiar with the case knows, the girls left for the night, did not come back, weren't seen for a day, considered AWOL, and had their stuff cleaned out. Notice was supposedly given to their family and the scanner, and that was that. The girls did not return home to Alaska. They did not return to Job Corps. They had simply vanished, and no one knew or perhaps even cared what happened to two young Eskimo women, as they were referred to. We would now refer to them as being Inuit. While on paper it makes sense that legally adult women would be able to come and go as they please, what is the point of getting a pass to leave the place if there aren't fail-safes to protect them? I can only imagine how long it would have taken to inform their families. It would have also taken several people to get that information up there. I didn't see anything about the families in Alaska reaching out to news outlets or asking questions. But again, you have to remember, these aren't just isolated places, but the technology was far from being efficient. Job Corps couldn't just send a text or even a fax. Starting a search for your adult daughter from thousands of miles away would have been nearly impossible. The rest of May passed without any sign of the teenagers. So did summer and fall. Around noon, on Sunday, December 3rd, 1978, a family from the city of Gearhart, which is 20 miles south of Astoria, was on the hunt for Christmas decor along the shore at Delray Beach. To be precise, it was 100 feet north of Delray Beach Access Road off of Highway 101, 2 miles north of Gearhart. If you're wondering why people would be getting trees and wreath supplies on a beach, well, there's a reason in Oregon we call it the coast. Not every point at the water is pretty and sandy.
What are you saying? It's forested?
Yes.
Oh.
As the family gathered pieces of greenery, they noticed a deer in a brushy, scrub, pine-covered dune area. So the man walked that direction. What he saw may have been confusing, or it may have put him into shock. Exposed out of the grass and pine needles was about 15 square inches of bone. He presumed it was a skull. The man, who worked for a Clatsop County school, did not call the police to report what he had found, at least not right then. It wouldn't be until Monday the 4th when he called it in. The man was later interviewed by the Daily Astorian, and he said, quote, "There's no real reason you would think it was a human. I saw some material. I thought it was just an old blanket. As it turned out, it was clothing." When police were informed, they arrived to that area around 10 p.m. on Monday. What he saw was indeed part of a skull, a human one. And what he thought was clothing was more likely the gag which had been put in the mouth. As the scene was processed, it was quickly confirmed to be the body of a young woman. She was face down with her hands bound behind her back in addition to the gag. She had clearly been murdered and been in that location for approximately 6 to 8 months. This was 7 months after Teresa and Elena were last seen at Job Corps. Kind of a weird connection, Teresa was in the Anchorage paper for her charges of disorderly conduct that were dropped on December 7th, 1977, 1 year and 2 days before her body was found. You know how I love dates connecting.
You do, May the 4th.
It took until Tuesday afternoon for the crime scene at the stabilized dune area west of Necoxy Creek, about half a mile inland, to be fully processed and the body removed. It was thought the cause of death was a gunshot, but decay made it impossible to tell at the scene. The body was taken to Portland for identification and examination. As the body left for Portland, the crime team, two investigators, a newspaper reporter, two state police troopers, and one off-duty sheriff's deputy went to the dunes to discuss next steps. The two investigators went to where the body had been and continued sifting the sand and soil, hoping to find additional clues. Because there is already a hunch the body found may have been one of the Job Corps girls, perhaps based on clothing or location, or maybe a missing persons report had casually been made just in case, they decided to fan out a bit more and search through the brushy area surrounding the dune. The search for a possible second body was launched. Literally, 2 minutes later, and only a few hundred feet from where the first body was found, a second body was discovered, not far from the same beach access road. Both bodies were to be processed in Portland. Because the second body was nearly missed, it was decided a thorough search of the area would be conducted just in case. No other bodies were found. By Thursday the 7th, both bodies were officially identified. Teresa Krause had dental work done while in Astoria. Her dental records confirmed her identification. Elena Jacobs had a rotted Job Corps identification card on her person. Surprisingly, there was nothing in the initial stages of the autopsy to indicate the cause of death had been a gunshot wound. Because of the level of decomposition, X-rays were taken of the remains to look for injuries, wounds, and potential causes of death. Additionally, the decomp made it impossible to tell if either of the women had been raped. Further examination showed Teresa was stabbed at least 4 times. Elena's cause of death was indeterminable. As for the investigation, it was noted that Elena, who was found first, had been bound and gagged with a terry cloth towel. Teresa didn't appear to have any restraints on her body. However, there were marks on her clothing that implied she had been wounded. I'm thinking that's maybe a hole in a shirt from a stab wound or something to that effect. We've been watching a lot of Mindhunter lately, so I can't help but try to fill in the blanks. So whether the girls were walking home or to the place they were going, they were possibly seen by a predator who saw them as an opportunity. If they were held at gunpoint or knife point, Elena was then tied up while the perpetrator attacked and killed Teresa and then Elena. They were in a secluded area, so maybe he just saw them there, attacked them there, killed them there, and then left them there. But that's purely my speculation of what could have happened. Police were hoping more clues remained at the location the bodies had been found, but it was such a large area they would need help. In what we'll call an interesting choice, they invited members of four local Boy Scout troops to aid in the search. So the Saturday after the bodies had been found, 25 Boy Scouts met with police at the dunes. Because Elena and Teresa were such close friends, had gone missing, and had been murdered together, police weren't expecting to find any additional bodies, but the location had proven to be a pretty decent hiding spot, so who knows what those kids would have stumbled across. What the search was really focused on was finding clues connected to the double homicide. And don't worry, none of the children were exposed to a dead body or anything. Now that the victims were identified and it was known when they had last been seen, police released photos and details about the women in hopes the public would help. Would have been cool if that info had been released back in May when they were maybe reported missing. But I digress. At the time, both Teresa and Elena were about 5'2" and 130 pounds. Teresa wore round-rimmed glasses and had shoulder-length black hair, which she would sometimes wear in curls. Elena had waist-length black hair. It was also reported that, yes, the girls would travel together, but perhaps they weren't the besties that they were first reported to be. Speaking with officials at Tongue Point, the girls were described as shy-type girls, not the type of people who would take off all the time. At that point, there was actual hope the case would be solved. By now, a telegram had been sent to the families in Alaska informing them of the discovery of their bodies. Investigators shared that, yes, the families had been informed back in May of the disappearances, and they were incredibly concerned. Family members informed their tribal officials, who contacted Alaskan Senator Ted Stevens to ask for help. And all those months prior, it was mentioned that there was concern of foul play. With help from the officials, the FBI was contacted. They declined to become involved as no federal law had been broken at that time, which it hadn't. But if anyone had taken just a minute to look into the situation, there maybe could have been an investigation earlier on. Pure speculation, but the girls were probably killed the night they were out. So at the very least, if those cries for help had been acknowledged, the girls could have been found early enough to know concrete causes of death and possibly even retain some physical evidence. By the time 1979 came around, the update on the case per the Clatsop County DA's office was, quote, "The progress we've been making has been in eliminating leads. One problem is that it's been 8 months since the murders occurred, and the longer the investigation goes, the harder it is for people to remember anything." Another hurdle was the perceived, quote, built-in hesitation of talking to the police. So even if another student on the campus had seen or known something, it was possible it would never be reported. The DA was still hopeful the case could be solved, comparing it to a case we covered in the episode Lover's Lane, saying, quote, "The Peyton Allen murder case that took place about 15 years ago in the area took over 5 years to break, but it was solved." One piece of information was important but didn't change much. A former Job Corps student claimed to have seen the girls on the 21st, the day after they acquired the pass. The date change doesn't add much to the investigation, and it could be very likely that 7 months later that person simply mixed up the dates. I reached out to Clatsop County Police and was told that this was an Oregon State Police case. The issue with that is I can't request records for an active case. Every time I looked into OSP for information, it led me back to Clatsop. I wrote them again, and again I was kindly redirected to OSP. While reading about the case, a district attorney investigator was mentioned several times, so I shifted my focus and I asked the Clatsop County DA for any information they could share. I was told by one of the ADAs that they knew that two girls were missing, but they, quote, actually learned more information from your email. I gave more information as far as who had been working on the case, and maybe that would help redirect. They said they were going to ask someone else in the DA's office. So if I do hear anything, I will absolutely put that in an update, but I wasn't going to sit on this episode and wait, hoping to hear something. So active my ass.
It's nice, though, to get a concrete response like that.
Yeah.
Where you understand. Now I understand. That's what you consider an active case.
Yeah.
That is nuts.
And it's been so long. That's the thing, too. It's been just long enough. We're at about 50 years, not quite 50 years. It's been just long enough to gather a lot of dust and be, quote unquote, forgotten. But it's also not long enough because people still remember it. She probably has family members that are still aware of this case, mm-hmm. and wondering and waiting to hear something. And to find it listed, okay, yeah, it's listed as an Oregon State Police cold case, but then at the bottom it says it's under Clatsop County. And then you go to Clatsop County and they say it's Oregon State. And then Oregon State says, who are you talking about? What? And you're just going in circles and circles and circles, and no one knows. Sadly, that is where the coverage for Elena and Teresa ends. No vigils, no reminders, no calls to action, just silence. If you happen to have any information about Elena Jacobs or Teresa Krause or Teresa Cruz, perhaps you were at Tongue Point at the time, or maybe you saw them, or you know something about their murders. If so, you are asked to call. Well, you aren't actually. Even on the Oregon State Cold Case website, there's a case number but no department to call. So I suppose Crime Stoppers of Oregon would maybe be a good option because they might know where it needs to go. As always, you can send any information our way and we can try to help you figure out who to contact with it.
Or if anyone even wants that information, it seems like maybe they don't.
Right. Or if you want to remain anonymous, we can always be the go-between. Whatever you have, even if you think it's the dumbest thing. Like I said, they made a really big deal of finding someone who said that it was the 21st, not the 20th. That didn't change anything, but maybe it does. So
I think it can help to narrow down for sure.
Yeah.
Just one tiny information can change the course of everything.
So maybe there was something going on. Like Josh said, I can look into what events were taking place or concerts or whatever you know. Somebody knows something. It's only been 50 years. So you're maybe in your early 70s, if not your late 60s. You're not that old. You know something.
Or if you're older and you know something, that's fine too.
Exactly.
Tell us.
You gotta tell somebody.
Yeah.
It's got to be known. So,
well, I hope someone reaches out or the sheriff gets back to you or whatever, or something.
Yeah,
if something happens, or if someone knows something, or bug the DA, listener. Can I say that?
Sure.
Bug them.
They're our employee.
Yeah.
We pay for their job.
I don't make a lot of money at all, but the meager amount I make, pennies go to their pockets.
Yeah.
So either take my pennies out your pocket or put those pennies to good use.
Yeah. The next time Elena and Teresa would be mentioned was in 2006 when a memorial was held at the entrance to Delray Beach. Jesuit Father Tom Gallagher had been on temporary assignment at Seaside, an Oregon coast town, after having been a missionary in Alaska for the previous 40 years. In fact, he knew Elena's family. The ceremony that day, filled with crosses, hymns, and prayer, was to honor those who had been found dead in the area, Teresa, Elena, and Doreen Raderman. In our next episode, I'll be sharing the details of Doreen's case and how, yes, someone was held responsible, but was he the only responsible party? Now that's a tease. The successful example, Sarah, was sent to Tongue Point in a... Oh, my God.
Your tongue point's getting your tongue twisted.
It sure is, because it's so gross.
Is that where they blew up the whale?
I don't remember where that was. It might have been.
Alexa, where did they blow up the whale? The whale exploded, or was exploded, in Florence, Oregon.
Florence.
Which is...
forced explosion.
Yeah, it was not... it did not volunteer for the explosion.
It would have eventually popped, but not exploded.
Yeah, it's halfway down the coast. The,
oh,
the whale
okay.
was like, that's about halfway.
I want everyone
I'm
to feel
go right there.
I want everyone to be able to come here. I want to be, I'll be right in the
flopped
middle.
Up on the beach and said, you deal with it. We love the whale.
The living situation was
bad.
Yep. Is that how we should do it? I'll just do a sentence and you finish it. Man, my brain is just having a hard day. For how rigid rules supposedly were at Job Corps, fuck you, pop-up. Job Corps isn't a military operation. On the 21st, a bad check would have shown that they didn't come back. A bad check.
Bad check?
Yep.
I don't know about sand.
Why do I have BO?
Probably from frustration.
No breathing. No, give me breathing.
I had to kind of control it because it was coffee. I didn't want that to go everywhere, but it got all over my mustache.
Did you hear a difference?
Sorry for that weird burp. Yeah.